All right. I don't even know what book this is.
It was like 3 weeks ago. What do you mean you don't know what book it is?
I don't know. We've been getting together for all these weeks now to record these podcasts, and I feel like...
Lo, these many months.
This time is just blending together. Yeah. We've watched my kids grow from,
it's all a blur. From
young children to older children.
I mean, your son's a lawyer now, right?
Yeah.
With a he lawyer. Just graduated law school. Law school.
I'm being... he's a lawologist. My son's a lawologist. What do you know? What do you know about laws?
Lawologist. It's ridiculous. I mean, the son of a computerologist. Like, what else? I mean, he was destined for greatness.
He was either going to be an artologist or a lawologist.
Artologist. Anyway.
Happy to say that.
It's sexist of me that I chose your son. Anyway.
We have no expectations for my daughters.
No. Maybe she can someday grow up to work at a fashion magazine. Can I just see her?
I hope one day she can be an assistant at a high powered woman.
So I'm Amy.
I'm Casey.
And this is the fucking Shipwreck Podcast.
We make podcasts.
Guys.
We make shipwreck porn. We've been doing it all night.
This was our first, I have to say, this is a show I was really excited about because this was our first one, like, back in our home turf. We had been, like, on the road and doing other shows, and we did, like, one in Petaluma for some reason.
Guys,
and
like, six people showed up for this thing.
Guys, Petaluma loves us so much, though. They were so excited. Shout out to Copperfields and Petaluma. They were so stoked on us. They loved us. Anyway, so
we know what? We love Petaluma. We're going to go back.
We're going to go back.
If you're in Petaluma right now listening to this podcast, we're coming for you.
Just wait. We're coming for you. We did some New York shows. Anyway, so we did all this crazy whirlwind stuff, and we had our book launch at Public Works. And then
I love that our junket was a show in New York and a show in Petaluma.
Public Works.
We've been everywhere.
But it was all in a month. That's actually pretty impressive.
I know. I agree. I know the work that went into it, yeah. But at the same time.
I know. But I mean, for a book, for an anthology?
Right.
Dude, let me tell you. Combined, more than 700 people showed up to an anthology launch.
Right. And
that's a big fucking
deal.
We
got writers from the anthology to go with us to Petaluma, which I don't know. You might not live in the Bay Area.
Of fun.
So if you're hearing this and you're like, I don't even know what that means, what I would say is
nobody. If you listen to My Favorite Murder, they talk about it a lot because that's where Karen Kilgariff is from. So there you go.
Literally nobody leaves San Francisco.
No, nobody goes.
Nobody leaves.
So
getting him to go like an hour out of town to go read.
And we drank really good cider and there was a dog there and it was so fun.
It was a great bar.
It was so fun. Anyway, so we did a bunch of crazy book launch stuff, and then we got to come back to the bookstore, and, you know, the bookstore is the Booksmith on Haight Street in the Upper Haight in San Francisco, and it's our home base. It's where we've been doing our show since 2013, and, you know, it always feels so much better here, no matter where we go, no matter what crazy things we do.
I love it. I mean, we get really excited about doing these tour shows or doing, like special one-off events, but it just always feels like we get super stressed out, and it feels like a lot of work as opposed to... Just it feeling fun.
Feels natural and fun, and I'm my most at ease when we're here.
It's like the difference between planning a wedding and planning a party at your house.
Yeah, I
mean, that's sort of
It's the difference between it's like the difference between planning a wedding and like everyone come over on New Year's Eve and wear your pajamas. We're gonna order Chinese food. Like that's what it feels like to be back at home. So
definitely.
You know, it's so good.
The thing we do is more of a slumber party. God, we have to do a lock-in, haunted lock-in.
God,
we have to do a haunted. We're doing it. Shipwreck lock-in.
We're doing it. We'll do like Poltergeist or something. It'll be great. Okay. Anyway, so this was our first show back home after the crazy book nonsense. And so we do this. We have this tradition that where every year we made a pact when we started the show that every year in the fall we would do a Stephen King book until either we ran out of Stephen King books or the sun exploded. And this is 4 years of Stephen King books. Mm-hmm. This is our fourth Stephen King November. We usually do it in October.
Yeah.
This year we had to do it in November because in October we were in New York. So this was our fourth annual Stephen King show. But our fourth annual Stephen King show.
Kingual tradition.
And I'll tell you what happened. We sort of just pick books based on what we feel like. And I was like, what about Pet Sematary? That sounds wacky. And Casey was like, sure, let's do it.
It's one of the ones I haven't. No, I have a lot of opinions about Stephen King. I've read them all.
That's true.
And all of my faves are nobody's faves.
Mm-hmm. So we've done The Shining. We did Christine. We did Carrie. Those are the three we did previously. So those are like kind of the big ones. I feel like those are like the most mediocre,
not The Shining, but like
no. But Carrie and especially Christine are like The ones where he's like really on coke, yeah. Nothing makes any sense, and it's just like wacky nonsense. So we were like, all right, well, we got to go into like sort of the I don't know, like the B list, you know, Stephen yeah. King. So which I was like, all right, let's do.
I mean, he's got like 9,000 books.
Saving, and we want to do it, but we're saving it for, personally, if you're listening, Shauna McGuire, I'm saving it for when we can get Shauna in here, because I know that's her favorite book of all time, and she's obsessed with Stephen King. So we've been kind of putting that one off until we can coordinate with her. But, so that was like the next probably super popular one. And then after that, mm-hmm. it's like, all right, we're kind of into like the, everyone kind of sort of knows it, but it's not like, so we chose Pet Sematary sort of at random. And what I didn't know, I thought... Don't laugh at me. I thought this was a book about like murderous undead pets coming back out of a cemetery to kill, I don't know, everyone. And see, it turns out.
I thought it was just.
You thought it was about a really ugly clown that comes.
No, I thought it was problematic for the time. Okay. Like, this is where, like.
It was problematic for all time.
When I was a kid in the 90s, we thought it was kind of cool when there was like Indian whatever's going on.
Mm hmm.
But now we absolutely know that that is horrendous.
And oh, especially like, for like should, Stephen King to be writing.
Hyper aware of like sensitivities that did not exist mm-hmm. at another time. So like I knew when we started picking this book, it was like we would not be assigning certain like.
And we didn't.
Gods.
And we didn't.
Different. And we did.
But here's what I didn't know. This is not a whimsical tale of undead dogs.
Or a mythological tale of any
what
sort.
What it is about is horrific, life-shattering grief. After your child dies and you break the laws of physics, time, and like, oh God, the universe to bring your child back to life, and then he murders you. That's what this fucking book is about.
Wow, that's metaphorical. What the that's entire kind of beautiful. Fuck? That, like, did you write that? Because that's beautiful.
I've had a few whiskeys.
Like on some level, you know. Child rearing is a sort of death of the self.
And, that's true.
And a shattering of reality.
Maybe that's what he was getting at.
Huh.
Maybe.
Wow, Stephen King.
Maybe this book is a lot deeper than we thought. Maybe it's not actually about ancient Indian burial grounds. Anyway, so it turned out to be like a really fucking sad story. It's sad. It's horrible.
Yeah.
First up, like just to kick it off with the mourning, is Zelda, who is dead for the entire book.
Zelda Goldman. The dirty family secret, the humanoid abomination, the biological disgrace, the repulsive and pathetic high-pitched moaning cockroach that took goddamn forever to die of spinal meningitis, stood beside the unmade bed, head cocked to the side, watching her sister Rachel get nailed from behind by her husband Lewis. They had only been going at it for a solid 3 minutes. Lewis still had his tube socks on. And Rachel had Gages, her little toddler son, smushed peas on her left knocker. But hey, with two young kids, she supposed they knew they had to get to it quickly whenever they could. Something stirred in Zelda. No longer did the feverish chills and aching of her contorted spine cause her misery. No longer did she have to lie in her own piss-stained sheets in that stuffy prison. Calling out to her sister for comfort or empathy, that was long gone. Though she did harbor a dark, everlasting resentment towards Rachel for being alive, that was another story. She hated her more so for getting to fuck. No, getting fucked by that dreamboat hunk of a man, Dr. Lewis Creed. Zelda had felt a hot white burning, a rushing of her blood through crooked spider veins that deflated at her and her putrid organs. It started from her toes, she thinks. It was hard to tell because her spine was all jacked up in an ungodly puzzle, but she felt a rising sensation near her overgrown lady forest. She reached into her panties, underneath her diarrhea green hospital gown, and flexed her forefinger in an upside-down come-hither motion to feel her womanly syrup. The newly resurrected cat, Church, clambered up to the top of the dresser and perched himself in a prime-viewing position, setting his eyes on Zelda. They weren't kindred. Church was a monstrous feline hellion that should have stayed flattened on the side of the road, not reanimated from the Micmac burying ground. Oh, Christ on a throne, Lewis said. The pussy reeks. What? said Rachel, bracing herself on the bed, arching her back like a pro. Not you. I meant church. He fucking stinks. He smells like roadkill. Well, honey, get him out of here. Lewis lunged for a pillow. Not the throw pillow, said Rachel. Lewis paused for a moment and thought, what the hell was a throw pillow anyway? And why was he thinking about this now? He hurled it either way. Church, no. That thing didn't even flinch. He bared his teeth and let out a stomach-grumbling squeal, his hybrid, standing his ground from atop the dresser. He looked like he was really enjoying the show. Lewis closed his eyes. He grabbed his wife's hips, guided her forward and back, slamming his manly joystick in and out of her. This was going to happen, he thought. Ever since they had moved to Ludlow, Maine, Zelda had noticed the strength inside of her. She had always appeared when Rachel was at her weakest, her most vulnerable. That's how this halfway limbo reality world worked for ghosts like her. So naturally, she was summoned every single time Rachel had cried or orgasmed. She willed herself to appear only when Lewis was in the spotlight. She couldn't stand looking at her sister's scrunched up face, her swollen, dirty pillows swinging back and forth, or her unevenly shaved pubes glistening with moist arousal juices around her prominent pleasure tic-tac. No, Zelda thought. Ew. She'd fixate on Doc Lewis's Herculean thigh muscles as they tightened and loosened, and zero in on his plump gluteus maximus. Ah, yes, Zelda thought, as it thrust like a jackhammer against her sister's noticeably straight backside. And imagine his hot, pulsating love thermometer gliding inside of her, and finally exploding, filling her up with the gooey viscosity of life. But that was all a cruel pipe dream in Zelda's mind. She'd never be able to satisfy herself or the doc, or be given his sticky sweetness. Life sucks, Zelda thought, and then sucks even more when you don't die. Pressure was building up inside of her. She couldn't take it anymore. Rachel! She screamed. Rachel! Adding a haunting undertone that seemed fitting. Rachel! Rachel shut up, smacking the top of her head against Lewis's chin. There was a juicy snap. The snap was either from Lewis's teeth clamping down on his tongue, sandwiched in between his hardened baton flop, or the snap was from his hardened baton flopping out of Rachel with a steady stream of incubated sensuous sauce. Darling, Rachel said. I'm so sorry, said Lewis. It's just that, Lewis groaned and steadied himself at the foot of the bed. I heard. You heard what, Rachel? He said. I think I heard Zelda. No, Rach. That's just your imagination. Just relax. They both willed themselves to get through this. They needed this. What's been tried once has been tried before. Wait. Was the cat talking to him, Lewis thought? Was he losing it? You hear me. Go for it. You know you want to. She was a ghost and could borrow what she overheard and whisper it to anyone. Judd, the old corn dog next door, had some choice phrases. A gaunt figure appeared in the opposite corner. He had a goofy smile plastered on his face and half his skull punched in like a pinata. His left brain, like ground turkey meat, glossed over with a crimson congealed blood and cranial fluid. Woof, Zelda thought. She drew in a long breath and exhaled. The barrier was not meant to be crossed. The ground beyond is sour. Victor Pascal, Lewis's personal ghost, said, gazing over at Zelda, you're thinking thoughts best not thought of. Oh, Jesus, not now, Pascal. I don't have time for your cryptic messages. Not now. Lewis thought, her beyond region. We've discussed it before. Lewis placed his palm on Rachel's back, ready to guide his resurrected husband Salami past the barrier into her beyond region. There's no stopping. Just don't stop and don't look down, Zelda said, parroting Judd. Judd had guided him past the pet cemetery with Church's body in a garbage bag. But right now, in this moment, those words meant something else. Something hot and something nasty. Don't go beyond, no matter how much you think you need to, Pascal said, as a last plea, now touching shoulders with Zelda. Sometimes, Zelda started. Sometimes. Pascal's hand traced Zelda's face, then her curved spine. He breathed her in, finding her decayed scent deeply layered with hints of rancid open sores, chunky toe cheese, and herbal essences. Zelda planted her lips on Pascal's temple. She licked the gaping hole in his head, running the tip of her tongue inside his skull, lapping up his cerebrospinal fluid. It was delicious. Pascal's body trembled. Her happy clam tingled. This was her moment. He pressed his eager meat muscle against her protruding spine, succumbing to the ribbed effect, gyrating against her bulging discs. In a raw, contorted sex pretzel, Zelda and Pascal succumbed to their temptation, and in 13 seconds climaxed together, both releasing gushing quantities of lubricant, both of the sex and blood varietals. In between cool-down breaths, Zelda finished her sentence, "Sometimes head is better." Or was it dead, she thought. Whatever. And she left Rachel and Lewis to finish up. Just as Lewis was about to put the tip in, just to try it, he flipped Rachel over, going to town. More like slurping up her downtown. The end.
That's Zelda as written by Jamie Rail. Jamie Rail.
It's always hard when I always feel like we're giving people extra work when we send them dead characters. So bless her heart.
It's really tough because it's basically
great.
You have to write the
her
book.
Her shit was so funny. Yeah. You have to just like make up a character who literally doesn't exist.
We make it hard for people sometimes.
We do. We're terrible. At least she didn't get assigned pork chops. next up we have Lewis Creed, who's the main character. He is a super fancy pants smart doctor guy who gets a swanky university doctor position in, you guessed it, wait for it, Maine.
Banger Maine.
And then loses his son horribly.
Truck car?
Yeah, I guess run over by a truck.
Truck car. I mean, you know, it happens.
Time makes fools of us all.
You live next to a highway.
I mean, his son was like, it was so fucked up. This son is like chasing a butterfly.
Yeah. And they really
like
play that up in the movie.
Run over
it's like
by
it takes
semi.
Like 30 minutes for that kid to get all the way.
It does. It's like most of the movie is that kid running in slow motion.
It's like, oh, geez. So it's just like a lot of sweaty cat.
63. He looked at his shoulder and saw a frigid but pristine hand resting there. He looked up and saw Rachel's face. She was beautiful. Though coated in dirt and soot, she was beautiful. Her extended hand was the only thing that looked untouched by the earth. She nearly looked like the wife he had sent to Chicago, except a deadness in her eyes. You were right, hun. You got to me in time. You couldn't save Gage. Her eyes flickered at the name. Gage, she continued, but you saved me. Lewis then knew he had not saved her. But he so yearned for this to be real, so needed her touch that he fell into her embrace. Rachel led him upstairs to their bedroom, where she backed him into the bed until he was flat on his back. She straddled him, and he rose to attention underneath what used to be her warm mound, which was now a chilly knoll. But it was welcomed nonetheless. She kissed him as she reached behind her to unleash him from his pants. She sat back and began to stroke his ready muscle up and down. He closed his eyes, as he often did when getting Rachel's go to move. And as he felt her mouth envelop him, to mid-shaft, he thought it was all worth it. It was all worth it for this moment. It wasn't until she let Lewis inside her and slid down his shaft that he smelled that stench. It was the death smell that Lewis had become oh so familiar with. When Church was still wandering the halls, he recognized it. "Lewis!" Rachel screamed as she bounced on top of him harder, faster, pounding more and more violently. "You killed my son, Lewis! You destroyed our family! You fucked a whore! You think I don't know?" She gripped his penis with her walls. He felt as though his entire body was being strangled. "Why do I have to talk about my vagina like it's food to get you to go down on me, Lewis?" She shrieked some more at Lewis. The pressure mounted. He felt Rachel getting wetter. Her moisture made him burn. Wind whipped through the room. Unbelievably, Lewis was still fully erect and nearing climax. Her grip around him reached its maximum when she pulled away from him, ripping his entire genitalia from his body before continuing the trajectory through the roof. She released his dick from inside her and cackled as she landed back down on the path behind the house. Lewis heard the thud as his organ hitting the roof. Then Rachel's footsteps that sped into the night. In shock and panic, he sat waiting for what came next. What came next was eerie silence. He looked up through the hole in his ceiling and saw an angry sky twisted with deep red. In the distance were two points of faint yellow light. The light was so soft, like the spots that dance on the eye after being exposed to a camera flash. But this light did not dance. It sat transfixed on the man, pathetically writhing in a pool of his own blood. The vision could have been caused by the pain radiating from his lower body, or it could have been the fatigue of the months and months of the long nightmare his life had become. But he knew what it really was. He was bought, just as he had bought Church and Gage and Rachel with every trip to the Mi'kmaq burial ground. He had sold himself to the demonic force that lived just beyond the pet cemetery. He was bought, and that thing that gripped him was checking on its investment. He continued to stare at the gaping hole above him, half expecting Rachel to fall back through it, half avoiding the throbbing open wound that had replaced his penis. He knew once he looked down, the panic and pain would become real. The hole would become a problem, and that problem would have to be solved. Slowly, he peered down at his pelvis. Where there was once something there was now nothing. He became unsteady. He felt as if he was falling into the void that was the gash splitting him. The void that was once his manhood, once his home, once his family. Now the house he was in and everything that surrounded him was a cemetery. He broke into a sweat thinking about all the bodies, thinking about Rachel, thinking about the pet cemetery. His brain fell over the misspelling like a tongue gliding over teeth. He looked down again. A roar of hysterical laughter came tearing through his body. Castrated, just like twice dead Church, he thought. His greatest fears realized. "No, Rachel, I won't be wandering into the road now, Rachel." As if on cue, a truck rolled by, seeming to shake the hollow house. Hollow but never empty. He pulled himself out of the bed. He was weak, trembling, but was no longer sustained by blood and breath. Doubled over, he stumbled to the bathroom and began reaching for bandages to seal his wound. He caught a glimpse of his aged face in the medicine cabinet mirror. For a moment, he could not remember if it was the culmination of traumatic events that had aged him or if that much time had actually passed since it all began. He was just about done haphazardly stuffing and cinching himself when he glanced at the mirror with the side of his eye. "You will not be destroyed," he thought. He made quick work of retrieving his ladder. Actually, it was the ladder Judd loaned him to clean out his gutters last fall. "I was certain I gave that back. No, never mind. He went up the ladder, stepped on the roof, and held his limp shaft and pallet balls in his hand. You won't end up like church, little guy, he said. And with that, he went to get his pick and shovel. 64. He hardly remembered passing over the hummocks and tussocks of the 45 steps he ascended. He could barely register the howl of the loons, all he heard reverberating in his ears as he climbed the path to the Mi'kmaq burial site once again was the thump of his penis colliding with the roof. That was a very interesting sound. It was only interrupted by Rachel's voice whispering, I'm sorry for being so awesome. And that way she does when she gets her way. You certainly have gotten your way this time. As he passed Little God Swamp again, the ground rumbled and the floating head with its slithering tongue faced him. This time the presence looked more eager than evil, waiting, seemingly needing to have the meat embedded into its ground. It seemed to usher Lewis along, not wanting him to be distracted. He reached the cemetery circle. He took his pick and violently penetrated the rocky sacred ground. He heard a roaring, masculine, orgasmic moan let out. But like better. Fear froze him. He tried to tell himself it was just the loons, but he knew better. He frantically dug what he deemed an above average but pretty good and useful size hole. Then he planted and covered his dismembered genitals with a cairn. Dazed, he returned home and sat and waited as he had done so many times before. Lewis went to sleep, sitting upright and facing his front door. He awoke to a thud above him. Without thinking, he stepped outside, grabbed Judd's ladder, and went up to the roof to get what was his. But his penis had his own plans. As Lewis ran to get it, it hopped up and poked Lewis in the eye. Lewis went, what the shit? And then fell backwards and fell off the roof. His penis jumped from the top of the house, knocking the wind out of Lewis as it landed right on his stomach. He reached out to grab his penis as it stood on its stomach, but it missed. His penis was so fast. The wayward penis escaped. He looked up and hovered towards the road. He crawled, following behind his penis as it maneuvered through the grass. Exhausted, Lewis hung his head down and struggled to regroup before trying to get to his feet. Then he heard the truck. He was like, oh God, no. Lewis pulled himself to his feet and got to the edge of the road, just in time to see an Orinco truck slam into what was left of his masculinity. And the glorious, gruesome splatter it left behind. The end.
That was Lewis Creed as written by Nicole Love.
Who had like never been to the show or written for it, and I always want to take those people and just like hug them.
Yeah, I feel like it takes a certain type of person.
Terrible world. But I mean, she nailed it.
She delivered it.
So next up was Church, who's Winston Churchill, who is the cat, who is the only actual person who gets buried in the pet cemetery, even though you'd think there were a lot of animals that get buried in the pet cemetery, but you were wrong.
Church sat bolt upright in his grave and smiled. He looked around and said, I'm back, bitches. Miles away, Lewis Creed paced around his kitchen. He was glad Rachel and the kids were away for the weekend. It'll never work, he muttered, and poured a glass of water. Church stumbled into the kitchen. Lewis squinted. Church, is that you? No, it's a young John Stamos. Of course it's me, you idiot. Church leaped onto the table. Lewis recoiled in disgust. You smell like sex. Damn right I do. Resurrection has changed me. I now have an insatiable thirst to fuck. He shifted uncomfortably and then asked, to fuck what? Relax, bitch. I would rather die than fuck you, all right? Humans are gross. I want to fuck animals. How are you going to do that? All the animals in this town are dead. Oh, I think you know. No. He whispered. I won't do it. Yes, you will, or I'll tell your precious Ellie that you killed me. But I didn't. And who's she gonna believe? Her pathetic little father or her incredible motherfucking talking cat? Yeah. Lewis sighed. Church had made an excellent point. Okay, we'll go to Pet Cemetery tomorrow. I'll dig one up, bury it in the Micmac, and you'll have an animal to screw. Happy? Even as he said it, the doctor was like, what the fuck am I saying? Now, Church said, we go tonight. I am horny as fuck. I'm on my 10th life, motherfucker. This pudsy needs a good dickin'. I need that shit. The doctor bowed his head. Fine. Church purred, then swiped Lewis's glass of water off the table. What the fuck was that for? I said, fine. Bitch, I may be dead, but I'm still a cat. What? They arrived at sunset. Church scanned the grave markers. He stopped at one that read, in memory of Marta, our pet rabbit. Get over here, Lewis, he shouted. I found a thumper and I want a humper, you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The doctor buried Marta in the Micmac and returned to the cemetery to wait with Church. Minutes later, they heard the clicking clacking of bunny bones. There she was, a cobbled together skeleton, dripping with dirt and decay. Oh, hail yeah, Church said, and then pounced on the bunny. He licked and sucked every tibia and fibula. He rubbed his penis up and down her ribcage like he was playing a xylophone with his penis. He humped his way all along her vertebral column until he reached her skull, where he literally, like, skull-fucked her. But just as he was about to come, her bones crumbled to dust. Church was furious. He was mad. God damn it, can you believe this shit? Church said. The doctor couldn't believe it either. Okay, I'm gonna go, said the doctor. Church let out a low, guttural growl. You're not going anywhere until I get my nut. Fine, said the doctor. Who's next? Church motioned to the marker, which read, Smucky the cat. He was obedient. I want a fucky Smucky. Let's do this, Lewis. The doctor groaned and picked up a shovel. It wasn't long before Church's new fuck zombie entered the cemetery. The mere sight of him made the doctor gag. Turns out obedient Smucky had been skinned alive. Every muscle was exposed and oozing with blood. Church pounced on Smucky and started to fuck him from behind, catty style. The deeper he went, the more blood spurted out. But, like, Smucky was, like, into it. Smucky was like, yeah. I fucking love a squirter, yelled Church.
Oh, my God.
Church could feel the climax bubbling up inside him. He dug his claws into Smucky's gluteal muscles, but couldn't really, like, get any purchase. Smucky's tendons were, like, falling away like tender meat off a bone. Church had literally fucked the flesh off Smucky, who was now just two tiny, bloody eyeballs. Lewis wondered why the hell he had watched this. He asked himself, I'm a doctor. I'm smart. Really, I could have just hid, like, behind a tree for fuck's sake. Now what, he asked. Church turned to Lewis. Eyes filled with rage, dig them all up. I'm hella horny. One by one, the resurrected animals came back to life, horny as fuck, only to get fucked to death again by Church. He pounded possessed parrots, hammered haunted hamsters, and even boned a bull that just happened to pass by. But every time, just as he was about to jizz, the animals would disintegrate. Church seethed with anger. These animals are all weak. I need something stronger. The doctor was exhausted. Church, my dude, like, Come on, man. You fucked a bull, dude. I am done, man. I'm a doctor. I shouldn't even be here. No. You are sticking around and you are not done, motherfucker, said Church. Yes, I am, Church. I've been digging all night and I've seen some shit. This is like too much shit, man. I am done. The doctor stuck the shovel into the ground for a dramatic effect, but it didn't stick. He bent down and touched the soil. The soil felt warm. He began to dig. It was another animal. He pushed the dirt away and saw its face. It was a Saint Bernard. They couldn't make out the name on the grave. It simply read, "A good boy gone bad." Aw, yeah, said Church. I like bad boys. Yeah. The dog's eyes snapped open. Holy shit, Church, it's alive, said the doctor. The dog got up on all fours. It was a beast, a huge beast. Its eyes were dark and angry, its fur soaked in blood, and rabbit foam poured from its mouth. Ooh, yeah, he's a cutie. I like that, Church called out to the doctor, who was now absolutely hiding behind a tree. The two animals circled each other like wrestlers in a ring. Church lunged forward and grabbed the dog's monster cock. The dog growled with excitement. Church dislocated his jaw, one of the many perks of being dead, and took the dog in his mouth. The roughness of Church's tongue grated against the dog's veiny shaft, causing him to shudder. Church could sense the dog was close, so he turned around and coyly lifted his tail to reveal his tiny kitty butthole. I just said that. Wow. Tiny kitty butthole. The dog got on its hind legs and plunged in his big old lipstick into Church's tight little cat ass. Church cried out in both pleasure and pain. The dog's schlong filled him up so much that he could actually taste the tip of it in his mouth. The dog furiously slammed himself into the cat. Church gripped the ground with his claws and let out a spine-chilling wail as his orgasm seared through his bloodless veins. Church was thrilled, but the dog wasn't done. Its whole body started to convulse, which caused dollops of bloody froth to fall onto Church's back. Its eyes widened, then boom! The dog roared as his demon cum shot through his dick and gushed out of Church's mouth. The sheer force of the ejaculation caused both the dog and Church to spin out of control, spraying gallons of spunk up into the trees like a freshly popped balloon filled with spunk. The cemetery looked like it was covered in giant cobwebs made of splooge. Cobwads, if you will. As much as Church enjoyed being used as a cum cannon, something inside him started to feel strange. The dog's dick kept expanding. Church's bones creaked and his skin began to tear. Then in one swift motion, poof! Church was split in two, and both sides of his body were flung to opposite ends of the cemetery. That was the last and final time Church died. The next day, Lewis's family returned. Ellie ran straight into his arms. Where's Church? Bad news, honey. Church died, but...
But you got me a doggy, Ellie squealed.
What? What dog? Said the doctor. He turned around. It was the dog. But its eyes were now bright and somehow kind. The doctor was confused, but his concern melted away when he saw how happy Ellie was. What are you going to call him? Rachel asked. Ellie shot them a look.
I think I'm going to call him Cujo.
And in that moment, Cujo's eyes turned dark. Thank you, guys. That was gross.
That was Church, as written by Amanda motherfucking Rosenberg.
God damn it, she's...
That was our number one piece.
And she can't come back this month, but she's going to come back eventually because she loves our fucking show.
Ah, she's so good.
But she writes for Killing My Lobster, by the way. Go see Killing My Lobster shows. So she's often busy on our shows, but she's a treasure.
And she's an
international treasure.
She hates the thing we do.
I know,
and she hates the work that she does.
I know, she hates it.
But she's so good.
If she could, yeah, she's amazing. All right, so we got more. Three more, in fact.
Yeah.
Judd Crandall is next. So Judd Crandall is So it's so funny in the book. This is so gross and terrible. But in the book, Lewis Creed moves into a house, and his next door neighbor, or his across the street neighbor, sorry, his across the street neighbor is this guy named Judd Crandall. And the whole time he talks, the whole first 30 pages of the book, he talks about how Judd Crandall is the father that he never had but always deserved. And then we were like, great, let's make porn about that.
Part one. Judd Crandall sat on the porch, waiting. Lewis would be here soon, and Judd would have to tell him the truth about what he'd done last night. Why there was still mud caked on his boots near the door. Why there was semen on everything inside Judd's house. Dried semen. Fresh semen. There was even semen on semen, which was probably on even more semen. How in Tim Buck's tippy toes am I going to explain all the jitsum? Judd thought, sipping his beer. How in the Dickens dimpled dick am I going to explain what I done? Judd heard the crunch of dried leaves in his front lawn and saw Lewis wrapped in shadow approaching. Howdy, Lewis. Hey, Judd, breathed Lewis as he walked up the steps and carefully sat. The sexual tension between them had a girth to it. Girth. Lewis, I got to say something, and part of you, you're gonna understand, and a part of you ain't gonna understand. I know you feel the power of that cemetery. It's like something's tweaking your nips, but when you look down, ain't nothing there. Now, I gotta tell you something, because you've been a good friend, and you deserve to know. It's okay, Judd. I know circumcision wasn't as popular when you were born. It's fine. I actually like it when the captain still has his cloak, you know what I mean? I do know what you mean, but that ain't it. I told you how I buried my dog out in that there place when I was a young'un, and he came back. Different. Well, that weren't the only thing I buried in the cemetery. When you lose things important to you, you want to bring them back. Well, what did you bury, Judd? You buried Norma there, didn't you? You couldn't just let her rest, and now she's back. Yeah. Yeah, I totally buried her out there, yeah, Judd interrupted. A few times, actually. Baker's dozen, if my memory serves me right. But look, that's not what I mean to tell you. Lewis, I buried my penis. Part two. Lewis jumped. Now calm your bunched britches down, Lewis. I'm being poetic. I buried my sex drive, not my actual penis. It's still down there. Don't worry. Don't you worry. My mojo, my je ne sais quoi, you know, my Colonel Colon Kramer, you know, my big old... I get it, Lewis said. Judd continued. Well, I buried it. Now it's back. But it's changed. Sometimes my boner pulses. Sometimes it twirls. Sometimes it vibrates. Sometimes it plays Hank Williams songs. Sometimes it turns into a golden scepter and plays just Hank Williams, actually. It just keeps playing Hank Williams. Anyway, I buried my sex drive in that evil, rotten place, and it's changed me. I don't want it to change you too, Lewis. Lewis's eyes shifted to the protruding phallus thumping against Judd's corduroys. Knock, knock, Lewis, it seemed to say. Don't you want to see who's there? Don't you want to find out if it smells like the earth and wood smoke? I bet it tastes like love, the love your father-in-law never gave you. Knock, knock, Lewis, who's there? You should come, Judd started. Inside you, Lewis whispered. His own cock rigid. What? No, I mean, come inside the house. A showin's better than a tellin'. Judd went to the door and let Lewis in. The smell hit him, like 20 years worth of sex smells had been trapped in Judd's house. The floor was lined with plastic sheets to catch bodily fluids. Clothing and costumes were everywhere. Fishnet stockings, rubber suits, and petticoats littered the floor. There was subtle movement in the room, too. Oh, God, there are animals in here, Lewis realized. There are pets from the fucking cemetery fucking in the house. Jod's old dog Spot was diddling a Dalmatian. Church was sandwiched between a tabby and a Persian. Snakes were scrogging lace garters. A cockatiel was shtipping a hamster on top of a rather large purple butt plug. There was even a goldfish doing a seahorse on a leather face mask. Look at that, Judd said. They don't even need water anymore. Isn't that nice? They just need their genitals. Judd, Lewis rasped, his throat dry. Did you boink the animals? Nah, Lewis, no. But Norma likes to watch them, and she likes them to watch us too. Unsteady footsteps approached from the kitchen. Norma appeared in the doorway, her stringy hair pulled into pigtails, threatening to fall off her scalp in chunks. She was wearing a blue and white cheerleader outfit that squeezed her pallid skin like burrata. She held crusty pom-poms. Her crusty pom-poms were caked with what looked like dried blood. Hello, Lewis, Norma croaked. Hello, a terrible sneer, showing off black and rotting teeth. You want to join us? Judd's a big, strong football player. He screws me like a cordless 5 a.m. P. DeWalt, and that's a good drill. But I'm down for a menage a trois. Norma unbuttoned her shirt. Her pendulous breasts were covered in maggots. Rotting skin fell off of her in sheets. Norma lurched forward and cackled, "Give me a F. Give me a U. Give me a..." Part three. Before she could finish, Judd grabbed Lewis by the arm and pulled him towards the stairs. "Wait, maybe she just wants a future in real estate or fusilli," Lewis stammered. "She don't want pasta, Lewis, trust me," Judd said. Judd led him into the bedroom and softly shut the door. Judd turned to Lewis. A wisp of snowy hair fell into his face. Lewis was turned on. "Look, now, I know what my sex drive is going to do to our friendship," Judd said bitterly. "What should I be for you? The cowboy, the senator, or should I dress up like one of them, you know, like one of them fuzzy animals you young people like? What do you want me to be?" God, he's so handsome, thought Lewis, like a lumberjack, a very sad lumberjack with a cursed dog, but still handsome. Lewis faced Judd. This was his chance. "You know what I want, Judd?" Lewis said. "You. You, Judd. Just you. That's all I want," Lewis said. "You had me, Judd. You had me at Let's Go Bury Your Daughter's Dead Cat." The two men were no longer afraid. Okay, sure, a little afraid. They were like, there were like demonic animals and putrid cheerleader downstairs doing who the fuck knows what. But still no longer afraid. Judd approached Lewis, caressed his cheek, and kissed him. Judd's chapped lips sent shockwaves down Lewis's spine. He felt Judd's stubble and bravely dipped his tongue gently in Judd's mouth. "He does taste like wood smoke. Oh my God, he tastes like home," Lewis thought. "He does remind me of my father-in-law. I wonder what that means. Whoa." In one graceful motion, Judd swept Lewis up in his arms and carried him to the bed. Lewis looked up at him with half-closed eyes and began to purr like a cat. A living cat, though, not one of those zombie cats. "You make me harder than hell's ham juice, Lewis," Judd whispered. "Yes, Judd, yes. Yes. There's only one thing I want to bury now. Your cock in my ass, Judd. That's what I want." There was a scramble of belt buckles and zippers. Lewis never realized how erotic full-body long johns were until he saw Judd's old manhood straining against them. As Lewis reached his hand through the P-flap, he thought he heard Hank Williams faintly playing. Judd stopped him tenderly and got up. "I want you more than a goat wants garbage, Lewis. But I left the good lube downstairs. I gotta get it back from Norma." Judd reached behind the dresser and pulled out a shotgun. "Keep your pecker peppered. I'll be right back." And turned to leave. Judd. Yes, Lewis. Can the animals watch us? Judd smiled a crooked, knowing smile at Lewis. Of course, my friend. Of course. The end.
That was Judd Crandall, as written by Elaine Gavin.
We've got a lot of first-timers on the show. It's the best. So love we it. Actually, this is another one of our, like, maybe number three worst assignments that we've ever given.
This might be the most vague one, because we didn't even assign the problem place. We just assigned the thing next to it.
Well, right, because we couldn't assign the Indian burial ground, because that would make us just as bad as Stephen King. So we assigned the pet cemetery, which is a sort of non-place.
Yeah. It's sort of the gateway.
I have the hiccups.
A child's plaything.
Yeah, that's it. They walk there once and they're like, this is sad. And like, that's the entire part that the pet cemetery plays. And we assigned it to someone because we're the worst. Mm-hmm.
This story is titled Backdoor Grave Sluts Number 9. Afterbirth of a Nation. Heavy Petting Edition. Stephen King sat at his writing desk late one night. Deep in the dark and hairy pits of the great estate of Maine, which is where he lived and where all of his stories took place. He ran a wrinkly hand through his silvery mane of hair and sighed a heavy sigh. Something cold and old and musty had taken root in his heart. Lately, he had been suffering from a combination of writer's block and indigestion. Feeling restless, he slipped on his boots and a jacket and headed out for a walk in search of inspiration for what he loved best, masturbation. He strolled towards the hill at the end of his property, flashlight in one hand and fleshlight in the other. There was a neatly mowed path cut into the tall grass. He followed this path, curving and sinuous, until he arrived at an archway of peeling boards and faded black paint that read, Pet Cemetery. Pet Cemetery, he thought. The cemetery's bulbous entrance tapered off into a long corridor carpeted by pine needles, which opened into two circular clearings bordered by dense underbrush. When viewed from the air, it resembled a massive dong. At the base, where the balls curved to meet, rose a tremendous deadfall, a wall of tangled branches and three limbs that basically said, keep the fuck out. And planted right before the deadfall were a series of headstones arranged in concentric circles to form a kind of labyrinth. King ambled towards it and gripped the fleshlight tighter. Hey-ho, let's go, he said, just as he was getting into the thrust of things, juices fizzing over the final resting place of Smucky the Cat. He heard rustling behind him. A figure was heading for the deadfall, bent over and clutching something. There were muffled sniffling sounds. The figure was crying. King fumbled for his flashlight and leapt back in surprise, dropping the fleshlight. It was the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Paul Ryan. His eyes blubbered with watery despair. What the fuck are you doing out here? King exclaimed. This is a blue state. The pick, the shovel, the American flag bandana tied around his forehead, Rambo style. No, this wasn't Ryan's first trip to the ancient burial grounds beyond the deadfall. He had been there many times before, trying to resurrect his dying conservative party. Literally speaking, and unknowingly, had set in motion the worst election season America had ever seen. Each Republican leader he attempted to reanimate had resulted in utter disaster. King wondered who Ryan had buried to bring about the rise of he who must not be elected, and shuddered. That was the twist to this tainted soil. Things will respond different and deadlier than they appear. Burier beware. King noticed something long and red peeking out from the congressman's pants like a fluffy crimson dingleberry. What's with the tail? He asked. It's actually a butt plug, sniffed Ryan. I tried reburying Ayn Rand, but all I got was a furry version of Ann Coulter. Oh, said Stephen King. I'm sorry, Ryan wept. I just don't know what to do anymore. Things only keep getting worse. No matter how hard I try, it's all my fault. He let go of his plastic hefty TM bag, and the remains of Antonin Scalia thumped to the ground. No, no, King sighed. It's my fault for writing about this place. Everything I write about is true, you know. I just never expected anyone in the Republican Party to actually read, you know? Let alone believe me. King frowned. He knew what he had to do, because only he could rectify this mistake. He stripped off his clothes and walked to the start of the graves. Thin tin cans flattened into makeshift flags of metal and pounded into cemetery's dirty, dirty loins. He took a deep breath, lowered himself to his knees, and started crawling on all fours into the labyrinth. Curiously aroused, Ryan quickly disrobed and followed suit. From above, the spiraling cemetery labyrinth resembled a giant dartboard. An old name for a dartboard is butt. But this word comes from the French word but, or if you speak French, however the fuck that's pronounced, meaning target. And they had arrived in the target's dead center, the perfect place for a butt-stuffing bonanza, or a bullseye. King began digging with his hands into the wet, damp earth, which was growing surprisingly warm and slightly steaming. Ryan had kept his flag bandana headband on, as well as the tail. It had gotten pretty muddy and now burst from his crack like a slimy turd. All right, Ryan, it's time for you to fuck me in the ass, King said. What? Ryan said, fuck me in the ass, King roared. Fuck me in the ass, Stephen King said. He plunged his cock into the hole he had dug in the ground as Ryan rammed his own fleshy fun stick into Stephen King's bung chute like a bookmark. Dirt was caked on thick under his dick, fingernails and other various skin folds. The soil was rich and loamy thanks to the many dead cats and dead tech people dumped there over the years. All of the cats were, unsurprisingly, Maine Coons. Breathless and bucking on the verge of climax, King felt Ryan pull out, or rather, felt him pulled out, hurled across the headstone, spurting jizz and dying screams. Something was coming, something big and blind and stumbling. It was blondish and hairy. It was huge, Y-U-G-E. It was the Wang Dango. At the head of its glistening wang bore a remarkable likeness to the puffy, penile face of Donald J. Trump. It drooled and dribbled a rancid sap of vitriolic pus and pre-cum. King grimaced. Just do it already, you monster. Its dark tower of power soared into King's gaping ass chasms. Yeah, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff comfort me. Paul Ryan's corpse squished underfoot. King stared into the House Speaker's dead, glassy eyes and saw his own reflection. Is the rectum a grave, he wondered, as the beast excavated the inner sanctum of his womb tomb, or womb tom tomb. And this, is this my grave I am digging? His dick barreled further into sandy subterranean as nuclear cannonballs carved vast canyons of pleasure through a sweaty valley of dank ass darkness. No, his ass replied, not today, buckaroo, not for you. I'm gonna live through this, King said. I'm gonna do it, come to Papa, Stephen King cried, his dong ripping through bedrock like a jackhammer. Suddenly the ground gave way. He tumbled down into a slippery sinkhole, the very earth around him contracting with miniature earthquakes and erupting in orgasmic spasms. They were falling fast, bent around and twisted back, end over end over end over end, until there was a white lightning flash and a splash as colossal wave of viscous, muddy, frothy cum rained down over them. And the forest above, the giant deadfall wall collapsed in an avalanche of branches and limbs, disintegrating the dead tech people and all the other people that had committed suicide and cat skeletons from their rest. Some of them became caught in the tree line where they dangled like lost kittens. And then all was quiet and still. Almost. A hand pierced through the ruins, clawing and scrambling for purchase. Gasping, Stephen King emerged from the earth. Dawn had broken. His writer's block had also lifted. Kill your darlings, he chuckled to himself. Amen to that. I'm fucking Stephen King, and nothing's gonna kill me, he said. And then slowly but surely dug his way out of the cemetery sticky clutches, reborn. The end.
And that was The Pet Cemetery, as written by Kathy Ames.
Returning chimp from Fahrenheit 451.
Kathy Ames.
Mysterious. All right, we got one more. Finally, the female character who isn't dead. Rachel Creed, who is Lewis Creed's wife, and she has this great scene. I don't know if you remember this, because I know you read it a long time ago, but she has this great scene in the beginning of the book where her husband, Lewis, goes to work, and he's like the head physician at the university hospital or whatever.
Yeah, big-time doctor guy.
And he goes to work. And someone gets hit by a car, and they drag him into the doctor's office, because that's where you bring people who are dying.
Sure, sure.
Doctor's office, it's before cell phones, I know. He has this really hard day. It's a long day. There's a dead guy. It's hard.
I gotta think he takes a bath.
So he comes home from work, and his wife had heard on the news and on the radio that he had, like, had this dead guy at his office. So he comes home from work, and he opens the door, and she's standing there in her little bra and panties. And even though she has a kid, she's, like, still super hot. Don't worry. Because, God forbid, she
should be. Well, I imagine some time has passed. She's had time to do CrossFit and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She worked off the baby weight. She's fine. So she's wearing her favorite, like, black bra and panties. And she, like, takes him to the bathtub. She draws a bath for him. And then she just, like, really slowly jerks him off for about a page and a half.
I'm a big fan of the slow jerk.
There's
page and a half
literally
jerk.
A page and a half of slow jerk in the bathtub.
What do you describe as a writer? Like, as a writer, if you're tackling the challenge of,
I don't,
like,
know. I mean, it's a mass market, so it's a short page and a half, but it's still a page and a half of him being in the tub, like, being slowly, like, jerked off.
I mean, do you, like, move a finger over the head a couple of times? Like, that ridge or, like...
Beats the shit out of me. Apparently, I'm not a good wife, because I don't fucking know. So... And then,
I don't know what you do for a page and a half with a wing.
They bang for a while, and he's like, man, I love my wife. And then I don't know, then he lets his kid get it run over by a car. He
kills his child.
That's it.
This last story is titled Misery Loves Company. Or The Five People You Fuck When You Get Into Heaven. Here we go. All right. Boom. Okay. Rachel was dead to begin with. Her weird zombie son had shanked the fuck out of her with her husband's scalpel. And you don't walk away from that shit. With her dying breath, she had cursed Maine, that quaint shithole with ominous musical score lurking around every aged tree and behind every fucking colonial house. But now, Rachel was dead. It is said, at least it is said by smug little assholes on Instagram, that it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. But the dead can do neither, and Rachel was among their number. Truly, she was all the way up shit creek without a paddle or even a single square of toilet paper, metaphorically speaking. But, and this is the important point, though Rachel was dead, she wasn't gone. The afterlife was dark and close and warm and wet, like a sleeping bag in those few glorious minutes between when you pee in it and when you realize you've peed in it. That sweet spot. And just like that golden minute in the piss-filled sleeping bag, Rachel's posthumous moment of serene comfort couldn't last forever. The afterlife shifted. Then squeezed, like a womb undergoing labor, or a ketchup packet someone just sat on by mistake, and Rachel squirted out of the nothingness and into a somethingness. She was sitting on a chair, hewn of dark wood. The ceilings of the room were high and vaulted, and the sconce-mounted lights flickered like torches. In the distance, she could see innumerable shadowy figures, garbed in inky black, scurrying to and fro on obscure missions. Before her, on a broad table, lay a thick and arcane tome. There was a faint and unmistakable scent of wood smoke in the air. Welcome to Pizzeria Uno. Home of the original deep dish pizza, said the woman sitting across from her. Oh, God, said Rachel, recoiling with a thousand birthday parties worth of childhood trauma. Oh, God, I fucking hate this place. Oh, I'm sorry, said the other woman. She was wearing some sort of old-timey getup. Her accent was the twee thick British of an American trying to make herself more fuckable and getting posh and scary spice confused. Like, literally, the only positive character fact about you is that you're from Chicago, so we tried our best, she smiled winsomely. That's all right, Rachel said. She had a soft spot for clueless British girls, a spot which she indulged in on more than one occasion during her junior year abroad in Cambridge. That's all right, Rachel said, as long as we leave this place and never come back. She rose to go. The other woman snapped her fingers and the entire setting disappeared, replaced by a lovely Yorkshire hillside in late afternoon. The grass ambled comfortably down to a narrow, oxbowing brook. It was a picture-perfect pastoral scene. Is that better? The woman asked. Quite, said Rachel and grinned. So, who exactly are you? She asked, taking a step towards the other lady. My name is Misery, the other woman said. And she took a coquettish half step towards Rachel. Misery Chastain. She batted her eyelashes and toyed with a small piece of lace, which Rachel was pretty sure was Victorian girl's semaphore for let's do it on this hillside. But she chose to play her cards slow. Well, Misery, said Rachel, gently brushing a lock of hair out of the other woman's face, where are we? Misery's eyes grew sad, and she turned fetchingly away, striking a pose of dramatic sorrow that invited one to go up behind her and wrap one's arms around her bee-corseted waist. So Rachel did. Misery sighed dolefully, but she shimmied backwards into Rachel, just shimmied back into her to embrace eagerly and comfy. This is heaven for female characters who are killed off and brought back to life by male authors or for weird narrative reasons, Misery said. Rachel was like, what the fuck did you just say? This is heaven for female characters who are killed off and brought back to life by male authors for weird narrative reasons, Misery said. Or Hafakawakwakbabatalamalamala, for short. I see, said Rachel. She had always suspected that she was a fictional character. Something about the thinness and vapidity of her interior life, her willingness to cry like a child, and the utter implausibility of the whole a random jogger's ghost is haunting my daughter thing that really clued her in. Or maybe it was her irrational willingness to give a naked bathtub handjob. This is a real actual scene, I'm not making it up. To a husband whose only real emotional connection was with their much older male next door neighbor and who never attended to her sexually, even a little. That felt like an author thing, and specifically a male author thing, not really like a person thing. At least, it turned out fictional characters, like dogs, do go to heaven. Is it just us here in heaven with, you know, really, really, really long name? Rachel asked. No, said Misery. There are lots of us. I just wanted some privacy. Her wriggling grew more pronounced and more libidinous. Rachel was done with waiting. She kissed Misery's neck gently, repeatedly, running her fingers over Misery's skin was like paging through the softest and most luxurious bound book imaginable. Misery sighed, and did that thing that romance novel female leads do on the cover of their like eponymous books, where they like lean back into their partner's embrace and sort of put one hand on their partner's neck and turn to face them, but their tits are still like sticking way out at the reader. You know that one? Like those contortionist comic book tits and ass poses? You know, like that, but for love. Love in heaven. Rachel didn't mind. She kissed Misery on the lips, and Misery broke out of her weird cover pose, and she kissed Rachel back. She kissed her chastely at first and then more eagerly. It was pretty much exactly like you'd expect a Victorian romance heroine who is discovering the joys of womanly love to kiss you. Rachel nibbled on Misery's ears, her jaw, her collarbone, and the other woman gasped coyly, oh, Rachel. Rachel worked frantically on Misery's various antiquated fasteners, snaps, bows, and other such torturous haberdashery. If only she'd had an interest in historical attire, or really any other interests at all. You know, said Misery, between sharp inhalations of delight and excitement. Oh, I told a bit of a fib earlier, Rachel growled attentively, while attempting to undo Misery's corset lace with her teeth. I didn't really want that much privacy. Mercy slipped from Rachel's grasp and twirled around. Come out, ladies! I know you're watching, girls! At her words, a dozen women popped out of the scenery, bounding out from behind rocks, striding purposefully over hillocks, clamoring damply from the river, and in one case emerging from underneath a camouflage net cunningly constructed out of reeds, leaves, and brightly colored bonnet ribbons. Welcome to that heaven with the really, really long name, said the one who'd used the cameo netting, a brunette in even more archaic garb than Misery. Misery sashayed over to her, wrapped herself around the woman's arm, and licked playfully at the violent gash in her neck, allowing her tongue to slip gently into the stab wound. I am Caitlin Stark. I see Misery has already shown you our ways, she added as she gave Misery's rump a purposeful but affectionate squeeze. Your ways, madam? Usually Rachel didn't go into all that like lady and peasant wench business, but Caitlin's haughty demeanor had her home fires burning, if you know what I mean. Life is simple here, Caitlin said. From dawn till dusk, we amuse ourselves with conversation and endless brunch by the banks of the river. You know, like that Amy Schumer sketch, Last Fuckable Day, from before she got all weird and racist, like that. And what about from dusk till dawn, Rachel asked. Caitlin Stark met Rachel's gaze. Her voice was the voice of a great lady, a sage diplomat, and a stern leader. Iron on stone. Caitlin Stark says, it's a total fuckfest. Rachel glanced to the west. The sun's last rays slipped away between the rolling hills. Let's go, she said. And so they did. A more decorous author would tread gently here, would give these women, so ill-used in canon, a chance at last in fanfic to find their peace. The narrative would not dance from plump lip to eager cunt to well-formed fist, but instead draw a respectful curtain over the whole scene. But fuck that, let's get into the porn! Yeah! Misery lifted her skirts above her head, revealing Victorian undergarments, most conspicuous in their total absence. Rachel had been headed that way anyway. And she dove into Misery's cunt like Katie Ledecky going off a diving board. No sooner than her tongue split those precious petals than she found her own lips pushed apart by the small but mighty fist of Laura from American Gods. Trinity from The Matrix hovered in the air, rotating eagerly as Beatrice from Dante's Paradiso braided her hair into an updo and put a series of small angelic hands up her butt. Buffy of vampire slaying fame strapped a wooden stake into the harness she'd worn since season 3 and pushed the tip gently into Jean Grey's from the X-Men's asshole. Then thrust with superhuman speed while Bella Swan, fangs bared, spanked the slayer with both hardcover and softcover Twilight editions, alternatingly. Caitlin Stark at first held herself above the fray, but eventually she permitted Riversong to pin her down on the hillside and gently finger her throat gash and down there gash, Baruch point at your junk, simultaneously. They fucked beyond reason. They fucked beyond time. They fucked beyond narrative. And in the sleepy hours of the early morning, when everything turned golden and warm, Misery nestled up against Rachel's breast, and Rachel put a hand gently on her shoulder and whispered, "Darling." The end.
And that was it. That's Rachel Creed as written by Jackoff Torrance. Now, what's interesting about Jackoff is I feel like we reached out to Jackoff not 48 hours
literally
before 48
hours.
Show happened.
And he was like, yeah, sure, whatever.
And Jackoff being, you know, I mean, it's classic
being
Jackoff Torrance.
Classic Jackoff.
He was like, I got this. Rolled in, did the thing. And I feel like, well, you know, like, I don't know about Pet Sematary, but like, generally speaking, like, like it did a thing.
Yeah, it's pretty
like
good.
A real thing.
It's pretty good.
That's our show.
Guys, thank you so much. Per usual, find us at booksmith.com/shipwreck. Come see us, please, on the first Thursday of every month at Booksmith in the Upper Haight in San Francisco. We do a live show on the first Thursday of every month. We pick a different book every month. We invite 6 different writers. It's a ton of fun. It's $10. It's super cheap. It's the best show in town. We're also on facebook.com/shipwrecksf. SF is the important part that makes us not about actual boats on the bottom of the ocean. Hashtag shipwrecksf on Twitter. We post backstories to Tumblr. We cut this show into a podcast every month, in theory, when we have time.
If you're
and,
in Seattle.
We have this little book that we call Loose Lips, which you can buy at anywhere books are sold, but especially at Booksmith, where we will sign it for you and draw dicks in it. And yeah, you can find us in Seattle in March.
Yeah, which I'm assuming is right around the corner.
You can find details on our website. But yeah, that's coming really
soon. Buy your tickets. If you're already at the Comic, if you're in Seattle or if you're going to the Emerald City, then buy your tickets. If you're already in Seattle, then just buy your tickets regardless. And we'll see you there.
Thanks, guys.
I don't see any movies matching Pet Sematary. That's because you spelled it wrong. What was the release date for the film Pet Sematary by Stephen King?
1989. How do you like me now?
What is this song?
Me and my fingers. Please keep all of this in the podcast. You have to keep all of this in here.
I hate Siri so much.
I know, she's the worst. They should have cast Siri to play Zelda.